Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise Above Justice Movement podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the founder and the host of the Rise Above Justice Movement, the podcast, and the Rise Above Justice Movement. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion as advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by my friend, collaborator, incredible human being, Audrey. Welcome to the podcast, all the way from Louisiana. There's a lot to celebrate right now in Louisiana, so I'd love for you to talk about that. But welcome to the podcast, my friend. It's been a long time coming. I'm so honored to sit down and talk with you, learn about the work you're doing in Louisiana that's also leaving rippling effects all across the country. So without further ado, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. So, yeah, this has been a very long time coming, actually. I think over a year in the making, if I had
Yes, it has.
to look
And
back and figure that out, like now that I'm thinking about it.
yeah, absolutely. So I am so excited to learn about, the work that you've been doing, what's inspired you to do it. So feel free to introduce yourself, walk us through a bit of your journey. This is the point where feel free to ramble, because I think by now our listeners are used to the rambling. They're used to the unhingedness. They're used to the raw conversations, and that's what we pride ourselves in the most with this podcast, is allowing people to just bring their whole self and their whole energy. I also bring this comedic approach to it, because obviously talking about these topics can be triggering to some audiences.
Right.
But feel free to introduce yourself and walk us through your journey, my friend. Again, it is an absolute honor.
So, I am Audrey Hayworth. I live in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. I am a survivor of childhood sex trafficking and child sexual abuse material, also known as CSAM. And I am a writer and advocate. I've been had some role in the advocacy world in the violence against women movement specifically since my early 20s, and I'm 47 now. So over 25, pushing 30 years ago is when I started this work. And so I do a lot more like, because my specialty is like what I would say is survivor-centered language. Which we can get into in a little bit, but it's really about like reframing the language that we use when we talk about survivors and how that can influence the culture at large when it comes to like policy and social change when it comes to that kind of stuff. I help out sometimes with policy work with the with our local sexual assault center, and I do help with their communications when it comes to if there's a big case that happens or legislation. And I am an appointee on a Senate task force on child sexual assault investigations. So I've had my hand in a lot of parts of this, and yeah, I mean, there's just so much, it's like it's crazy to me now that like I look back and I'm like, it feels like it went by in a blink, but also like progress takes so long, and I think one of the things that we're going to talk about today is like something that took very long time that just came to fruition recently. So, yeah, that's me. It's and
Yeah.
Louisiana has, I mean, as does every community or in state in the nation, but we rank as one of, depending on what you're looking at, which, oh my gosh, I'm like blanking. It depends on like what like poll you're looking at or research study, but we rank always as one of the most dangerous states for women and children. And so change to change, like for to see change reflected in that data, it takes a very, very long time. You know, progress moves very slow, as we all know. So yeah. And let me just say for your viewers and anybody who's like listening, Zachary knows this, but I was in a car accident a few months ago, and I'm still dealing with post-concussive stuff. So if y'all hear me searching for a word, that is why. So just please have some patience. So.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I have the utmost respect for you, Audrey, because everything that you do is so deeply inspiring, and it leaves those rippling effects, not only in our survivor community, which is not a community that anybody really asked to be a part of or wanted to be a part of, obviously, but at the same time, finding that community and finding those people that you can surround yourself with that just understand the complexity of the issues around sexual and gender-based violence, you know, childhood sexual abuse, because oftentimes survivors of childhood sexual abuse are oftentimes looked over and left even further marginalized and left outside of the conversation, not recognizing that what happens to us as children does lead into adolescence and also almost said doghood, because you have your dog in your lap, so I almost said doghood. But the adulthood, and it does leave an effect, you know, leading into that. And oftentimes it's suppressed because you're told that if you say anything, it's going to lead into, you know, this, like XYZ. And you know that, I know that. I've heard some horrific stories. You know, being the founder of this movement and having over 200,000 followers across social media, you can imagine the DMs that we receive literally on a daily basis with stories all across the globe of these horrific horror stories. Now, to anybody out there, you know, our podcast is labeled as true crime. And then the subgenre is politics, because we talk about a lot of true crime and politics. I mean, look at the state of the country. We're in this whole ass like true crime world right now. Right. And it's all becoming too reality. it's all coming to fruition, and it's been a long time in the making. This is not something that just happened overnight. But I do feel a little bit hopeful, because in New Orleans,
yes,
the very first Latina mayor and the second woman to ever lead the city, but also spent time on the city council and in the state legislature, that did some badass work for survivors and led the change of ending the rape kit backlog in the state and did some incredible work. So I would love for you to kind of, you know, share your reaction on that. And then also, you know, your interaction with the legislators and what you worked on in the state of Louisiana. And then also kind of talk a little bit about your own personal experiences, how much ever you want to share about it, because I know there's still some things that can be a little triggering, and I want to make sure that, you know, anybody who's listening that.
Yeah. I mean, like, I want to preface, like, the stuff that we'll talk about today. I mean, if you don't know me, like, I'm a known, like, I will talk about this at length and very in depth, because I think it's very important that so many survivors have been silenced. And so I think I want to talk about Helena Moreno, the mayor-elect of New Orleans. And then I want to talk about the legislature and really about the last 3 years of what is like the culmination of all my work, and then the village that I built, and then the legislation that came as part of that. So I think that's where we'll go. But I want to talk about Helena Moreno. She's amazing. She, as if you're not familiar with South Louisiana, post-Katrina, when a lot of people evacuated from New Orleans, a lot of New Orleans residents moved to Baton Rouge and would commute back and forth for work until the city was rebuilt. And in doing so, our population exploded in Baton Rouge. And so if you I mean, we have terrible traffic. But in doing so, during that time, the cities started to sort of crawl towards each other. So anything that happens in Baton Rouge affects New Orleans, and anything that happens in New Orleans affects Baton Rouge, and vice versa. And Helena has always been an excellent advocate for survivors of sexual violence. And in fact, she has been a huge supporter of STAR, which is the Sexual Trauma and Response Center here in Baton Rouge and like the lower half of the state. And so like every year for our gala, she is the host of it. And so it's very encouraging to have such a strong voice in position in New Orleans. So very, very excited about that. And as you said, she was in the Louisiana legislature for a while too. So it gives her a lot of experience, and anything that happens in New Orleans affects the rest of the state, you know, with tourism dollars and yeah, I mean, I'm sure everybody like can see that. So let's talk about the legislature and how. So I want to talk about the path to getting a bill named after me this year, because I think it's important when we talk about progress and how slow something happens, that we're very realistic in the hurdles and the time that it takes to enact change. So one of the things that I'm always very interested in and very frustrated in is systemic failures and just any kind of systemic failure. Because a lot of times I think that we tell survivors, you know, to disclose and report, and there's just so many ways that a survivor will not get what they need. And so like the advocates in this field, we're constantly working towards removing those hurdles, right? But it's so much, and none of us chose to be in this, like as an advocate in this world, right? I always say that I didn't choose advocacy. Advocacy chose me, because no one's going to wake up and be like, this is the kind of advocacy work I'm going to do. It's very hard. It's very disappointing and discouraging. And like, you know, I get a lot of pushback and hate and nastiness just for telling my story. And I think that's something that's, you know, I think lost a lot, is that people don't understand that, like, when survivors do disclose, they're taking on a very real risk of isolating themselves even further. And we need to start to build support services to address some of that. So, as I said earlier, that I'm a survivor of childhood sex trafficking and CSAM, and I was trafficked by my grandparents as a child, and they shot video and made material of me and sold me to men in their community. And this was, you know, 40 years ago in another state. And while it's interesting as like an adult now, that like I've always recognized that I was trafficked, but when I self-identify, I've never been like, I am a trafficking survivor, right? This is where this language comes into. It's always been, I am a survivor of sexual violence, like period, the end for me. And it was always important for me to just sort of like broadly identify as that, because I never wanted a survivor that needed to disclose to feel like they didn't fit within some certain definition of sexual violence, right? And But I started like a few years ago, I was like, I have to start using these right words when I publicly talk about this, because people so misunderstand the way that trafficking happens. And this like fictional version that you see in the movies and stuff is just not accurate. But the one thing that I never publicly disclosed until my grandparents died, this was in January 2021. And well, it was December 31st, 2020. So the world, the year that everything went down, like just sort of exploded on the world. But my grandfather died. And the one secret I had held back was that I knew that there was material in their house, probably, that they had not gotten rid of in the last, you know, 40 years. And so you know, I had to have an attorney get involved. And at the time, I have two boys, and at the time they were both still in high school. And I had always been very intentional on never disclosing any of that publicly, because I wanted to make sure that they understood that at the time, and until August 1st, it was the material was always referred to legally in our state as child pornography. And pornography is viewed as consensual in most cases, like with adults, right? But child sexual assault material is not consensual. It is evidence of a crime. And so having to like make sure that if my children, like I didn't want them to come home from school and be like, yeah, well, a friend of mine heard you testify today or heard you give an interview, and them not understanding what actually happened. And so they knew that I was a survivor. They knew, you know, the very broad strokes that I've been public about. But I wanted the opportunity to have those conversations with them first. And so my grandfather died, and gosh, about a year, it was about 18 months went by, and I started to relax because it was like nothing was ever found. And, but you know, you're always worried that the other shoe's going to drop. And on very early morning, one morning in August, 3 years ago, I got a phone call that material had been found of me. And then about an hour later, I got another call saying that my grandparents' house was being sold and it was closing in the next 10 days. So like I knew just for my own peace of mind, I had to get my ass on a plane, excuse my language, and I needed to see for myself that the house was empty, like the attic and all of those things, or I knew I would never sleep again. And so later that year, you know, I was able to have conversations with my kids and explain to them like more of what happened. And all of that sort of came about because after Dobbs fell, Louisiana is, we have zero access to abortion. And so I got involved in trying to at least get abortion rights for survivors of rape and incest, which never passed. And so State Representative Delisha Boyd has brought that for the last 3 years. And starting 2 years ago, it was for minors. And of course, it hasn't passed out of committee. But I knew that I would start talking about my own personal experience during those hearings. And I needed, you know, I wanted my kids to have the opportunity to ask questions before their peers could hear about it. So all of that started. And throughout this whole time, you know, I've always had a problem with the language child pornography. Like I just, it's difficult to explain to somebody, but it's like, there's just no part of that that I consented to. And it's part of a criminal act. And so it was like, so going back to that day in August when I found out. So the current CEO of STAR, the Sexual Trauma Response Center, is a longtime friend, very close friend, close colleague of mine. And I had to meet with the FBI that week. And I have access to hire an attorney in our community if I needed to. But there was nobody else that I trusted to show up with me that day than her. And her name's Morgan LaMondre. So Morgan used to be, she started the legal division of STAR. And she basically has authored the majority of sexual violence and sex crime legislation in our state in the last decade. So, you know, she's like, she knows more about the laws in our state when it comes to sex crime than any other person living here. And so it was a very, very, even now, it's been over 3 years, and that moment, that day felt very surreal. That I've never felt as vulnerable as I did in that morning, like as an adult. I mean, they're just, it hasn't happened. It didn't happen before. It didn't happen. Hasn't happened since. And, you know, here I am with like basically colleagues and needing these services myself. And so, you know, it was just, it was a very, that relationship I have with Morgan is very meaningful for me. And that year is when I started telling, like, I mean, there were less than 10 people that knew like the full scope. Like, I got on a plane and went to another state. It was a secret trip. My best friend came with me. My husband stayed home with the kids because they started school that week. And, you know, there were just very few people that I trusted to keep that part of my story secret until it was time for it to be told, and that they completely understood that for my children's safety, and for respect, out of respect for them, that they had the opportunity to hear from it first. Like they kept the secret for me. And one of the people that were in that small group is State Representative Vanessa Castle-LaFleur. And so Vanessa has been, I mean, one of my best friends since I moved to Baton Rouge all those years ago. We met in the junior league, and we just really, she's just a kindred spirit. And I knew that I could trust her to hold space for me. And so, you know, over the last few years, we've talked about changing the language, and I can't speak for other states, but Louisiana, every other year is a fiscal year. And then every other year is, you know, the regular legislation, but each state representative and senator has a max of the bills that they can file. Okay. And so you're prioritizing things every year. And you have to, like, in order to pass some of these things, you have to get, you know, you have to sort of build consensus. Like, this is important to my constituents, and this is important that this gets passed. And there have been other bills, you know, in the last few years that were important for survivors in our state. But this year, Morgan and I have been talking for a very long time about how can we get this passed, because there were a lot of people in the legal community that just did not feel like it was a priority, because they didn't feel like the language change. Well, I'm sorry, like I'm skipping over what the bill is. It was to change in the state statutes the language from child pornography to child sexual abuse material. Okay. So there were a lot of people that felt like we have higher priorities than that. But in disclosing the rest of my story a few years ago, now, and like, mind you, so it's not like my story is new to the state of Louisiana. I've been freelancing and writing for over a decade on this. So like, it's a known, I'm in like a known quantity, right? Like there's a lot of times that I'm often the only survivor that will show up and testify, depending on what the bill is. Because it can be a very hostile environment. And, but what happened when I was able to start giving the rest of my story in public testimony, it really started opening a door to say, like, this is why it matters. And not only is this very personal to me because I've experienced it, but like professionally, this is my lane. And I can say without a doubt that this matters. It matters for survivors. If you're going to, you know, encourage more disclosures and all of those things, like the language absolutely will affect whether or not someone discloses, and how will their like story unfold and end. Additionally, during that time, I started having a lot of additional medical issues that had cropped up as it does with survivors of child sexual abuse. So I have scar tissue in my genital area, and that for years has affected how my bladder functions. And in my early 30s, I had to start using catheters and spending exorbitant amounts on medical bills just to manage my day-to-day medical life, because it just, my body just doesn't function the way it's supposed to when it comes to my bladder, which in turn affected my kidneys, right? So it's like this domino effect. So I guess it was about 2 years ago. No, it was about 3 years ago. It was around the same time that, you know, I got the phone call. I had to meet with FBI. I had to get on a plane. I had taken a trip with my husband and two children, and we were in Sicily and in Taormina, which is where the White Lotus was filmed, and like the previous season. And so, you know, it's just like this very glamorous, you know, town. And we were walking down. Now, mind you, like, let me back up. I had a hysterectomy at 30. So I haven't had a period in, you know, 17 years. I haven't had a cycle. And we're walking down these cobblestone streets in Taormina, and like the water, you know, is like glittering like diamonds. And I felt something running down my leg. And I was like, what on earth? And I went to the bathroom and I was bleeding. And turned out that one of my external scars had broken down and had torn. And basically I had like an episiotomy rip just from walking. So like, yay aging and things breaking down. But it really like coincided with like all of these like turns to my own personal story and where I was going in advocacy. So like there was one day that I was given testimony, and the following year, and I had spent 8 weeks on bed rest the previous year because the tears had been so severe, and we were trying out different things to try to heal it with, you know, my team of physicians and, I was testifying on a bill I can't even remember which one it was. Like, I can't remember the number because it's had so many numbers at this point on trying to get access for the, you know, child survivors of rape and incest. And I could barely sit. I could barely sit down as I'm talking about why children deserve that if a child is impregnated as a result of sexual violence, they should not be forced to carry a child to term. And I was screamed at that day. I was like physically touched that day. I was doxxed. All of that. I mean, it was just very hostile. And all the while that I'm sitting there and I'm like, I can't even sit down comfortably and give this testimony because of something that happened to me 40 years ago, which is ridiculous, right? Like all of these people that were like, so against like whatever, it's like, oh, you know, well, we draw the line here. So anyhow, so all of that to say, so we come to ahead of this last session, which was a fiscal session. And Morgan and I have been talking for a while about like, we want to change this language. Vanessa and I had some of these conversations, and she's the vice chair of the Criminal Justice Committee in the House of Representatives. And, randomly, I always testify in front of her in her committee, which is awesome because she's, you know, one of the safe people for me. But, this year on the last day that we were able to file bills, she had an extra spot. And so I asked her, I was like, will you carry this legislation? And she's like, absolutely. And so that's where it started. And so I would say, and I'm going to get emotional talking about this, but one of the most profound moments of my life was sitting at the witness table with Morgan and Vanessa, because Vanessa, you know, it was her bill. She sponsored the bill. She brought it before her committee. So she comes down from the dais and, you know, sits down at the witness table with me and Morgan. And just the fact that these two women that were my village and my support system throughout all of this, it was really truly one of the most profound moments of my life. And the night before, Morgan had called me and was just like, hey, I want to give you a heads up. Like, we want to name the bill after you. Vanessa and I have had long conversations about it. And, but we knew that you wouldn't want to be blindsided, which was a good thing. Cause I was like, are you fucking sure? Is what I said. I was like, I don't think so. Because I didn't feel like, no one does this work for recognition, right? But like, I also recognize that at the end of the day, it puts a name behind the legislation, like an actual person that this is affected and this is why it matters. And so it was really one of the most profound moments of my life. And then, you know, my husband and my oldest son were able to witness me testifying that day. And then when it went to the Senate side, my youngest son was able to witness it. And then when it was read on in on the Senate floor, Senator Regina Barrow carried it on the Senate side. And she is the chair of the task force that I'm appointed to. And so she recognized me on the floor. You know, the Secretary of the Senate is someone that I've known for over a decade through Junior League as well, that I met. And so it was just very, very, it was just a very, very special time that, you know, this happened. And so we had a bill signing ceremony, and as of August 1st, the bill went into effect, and it's it was HB 268 was the bill number, and it's now Act 261, and which is the Audrey Wascom Act. And so as of August 1st, it was effective. And one of the things that was really profound for me too is Wascom is, you know, my married name. And I had done so many things to like protect my kids' safety growing up, and like, you know, my professional work has always been under Hayworth. I always use different names for my kids online. Like, I did all of these things, right, to like protect them in case the people that trafficked me were able to track me down, that they would be protected. And so for me, it was very meaningful that they were old enough that I could use my married last name, that is their last name, that my kids' last name, that they were old enough that they could understand that that was like a really meaningful thing, that I could use my actual last name for them. And I don't have to worry that their safety would be at risk. And so, you know, it's just been a very long, long road. And I don't know, it's just, you know, when I tell people, like, it always feels like three steps forward, two steps back when it comes to advocacy and activism work, and especially in Louisiana. We have more problems than solutions, but I think that there are people here that, you know, who stay, who love the state, that want better. And, you know, I'm proud to be a part of that work. So I think that's a very circuitous way to get up to date.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, thank you so much for sharing everything that you just shared, because it's so important to recognize the work happening across the country, and especially in states like Louisiana, and then also states like here in Kansas, where I am, and then my home state of Missouri. So recognizing a lot of the progress going on across the country is greatly exciting to see. And there's a lot of momentum right now. You know, there's candidates that won their races all across the country. And, you know, shout out to all of them for winning their elections, including some of my friends that also won their elections as well. And I think it's so incredibly crucial at this very moment to understand that elections have consequences, and to understand that no matter how big or how small the election is, every single election matters. And that's the reality of that. So,
well, so one of my passion projects has always been electing more women. Okay. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just very passionate about that. I mean, we now have 14 female governors as of last week, and which is huge progress, but also like women are still not represented equally. And when people are like, oh, I don't care about politics, it's like your life is political. Everything that, like, what I think one of the things is that people see all of this, like, you know, outrage or excitement, and they're like, well, it doesn't really affect me. It's like, yes, it does. And so when people are like, well, it's too overwhelming, I don't know where to start, I'm always like, start as local as you can, right? Like the Public Service Commission, like the things that affect your day-to-day are the local races. And, you know, the majority of national politicians and elected people in office got their start in smaller offices. And so it's like, if you want to be influence, you know, policy change at all, I mean, we're talking down to like, you know, what your water bill is, or, you know, what's happening in school boards, you know, all of those things, those matter. So yeah. And then I think, you know, for like Louisiana, like obviously there's a lot of change here. And one of the things that we're looking to do is like start working towards changing federal legislation, to change the language to be in line with international language guidelines. So, I feel like I might have skipped over something just because, like, I'm all over the place. So, like, do I need to fill something in?
I think you did a really good job at, you know, highlighting the work that's happening. And something that I'm genuinely curious about is what are you hearing within, like, the community, and what are you hearing with, like, from other survivors about the work that's happening in Louisiana?
I think one of the things, I think collectively, right, as a whole, survivors, they want more for other survivors. And anything that they're, like, we're talking about policy and, like, things changing, unfortunately, they know that it's not going to change any outcome for them, but it might change something for their neighbor or their child or their sister, or, you know, their son. And unfortunately, a lot of these, like, cracks in the system, or, you know, kids fall through the cracks, or a survivor, you know, reports and, you know, there's failures in the system, right? It's that a lot of that isn't always apparent until it happens, right? Like, you're like, oh crap, that crack needs to be filled. And I think that the more that people are very, you know, I'm very much of, like, I don't believe things happen for a reason. Like, I just don't. But I also feel like this is part of the reason that I've been put on this earth, is to be very authentic about this and how sexual violence has affected my life. You know, and I do see survivors that come forward and are saying, like, you know, I see progress and I see these changes. And, you know, it encourages them to either seek professional help, like through therapy, or, you know, it might be their child and they're like, okay, well, like, I read about this, you know, legislation or this new program. And, you know, I think it's encouraging. You know, I think a lot of days it feels discouraging, but then we have, like, wins, you know, like, that get passed, and or new programs that pop up. Or, you know, I'll personally, you know, get a text or, you know, a message from somebody being like, you know, I sought help because, like, I met so-and-so, or, you know, I'm finally ready to handle, you know, to address the repercussions of how this affected my life. And, yeah. So, I mean, I get very encouraged some days, but then I'm also realistic enough to know that progress takes a very long time. And I think a lot of people get discouraged when things don't happen overnight. And that's just, until we shift blame from survivors and onto the perpetrators, we still have a lot of progress to go.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I have to agree with that at the highest extent, because we all know that healing journeys are different.
Very, you know, much.
And It's not linear. It's very complex.
Yeah.
And recognizing how complex it actually is, I think that is something that is definitely very interesting to sit back and just kind of hear where other survivors are in their healing journeys.
Well, it is. And, you know, the other thing too is that, like, I'm old enough now that, you know, I have one child in college, one is a senior in high school. I've been married for 21 years. I have, like, miraculously, I'm married, you know, and have had just a very safe and happy and healthy marriage. And which, as a 47-year-old and being married 21 years, I put in so much work, right, in therapy and, like, healing before I met my husband. But I am also witnessing in real time people that I know that are survivors that never addressed it and felt like I can just ignore it, or I'm going to, like, intellectualize my way out of this. And unfortunately, that's just not the way it works, right? Like, trauma rewires your brain in a way that affects everything. It affects the way you show up in your neighborhood, in your job, in the way you interact with the clerk at the grocery store. Every single interaction that you have with the outside world, outside of yourself, is colored by this lens. And so I think, like, for me, you know, I'm watching people go through, you know, separations and divorces or estranged from their children. And it almost always can go back to unhealed trauma. And I think I hear myself saying a lot to people that if you do not handle it yourself, it will handle you. Your trauma will handle you. And whether it is through an addiction or an unhealthy relationship or affecting how you parent, your work relationships. And I just truly, truly believe that everyone deserves to live a peaceful life. And I mean, look, it's, I mean, I will never, ever sugarcoat that healing from trauma like this. It's terrible. Like, you can't, there's no shortcut through hell, right? Like, you can't walk around it. You can't go, like, move on the outskirts. Like, you can't just, like, okay, I'm just going to drag my toe around the edge. It's like, okay, well, I'm either going to do this or I'm not. And healing is a lifetime. It's not like, you know, I did the majority of it when I was younger. Like, you know, I had very, very intense treatment, but, you know, it didn't end there. You know, like, I'm always aware that my trauma could affect the way I show up as a mom, as a wife, as a friend, as a colleague. And so just being very aware of that, I mean, really, that's what I want for all survivors, is for them to live the life that they want and at peace. Did I answer your question, or did I go off on another tangent?
Kind of both. And I'm actually glad, because it actually flows very well into the next question. And, you know, the next question that I have for you is, yeah, what has healing looked like for you? You know, what has been that healing journey looked like for you? And, you know, what's worked, what hasn't worked? And just, let's paint that picture that it's very complex. Well, what have worked for me may not have worked for you, and vice versa.
Right.
And what are you also seeing amongst, like, the survivor community too?
I mean, I think for me, like, I've always been very upfront with, for me, like, I have severe OCD, and how that showed up manifesting triggered by my trauma was that I have been in recovery for anorexia for, I mean, since I was, you know, late teens, early 20s. And even at 47, that is something that is, I make a choice every morning, right? That I am not going to starve myself. And what does that look like, right? You know, for me, it was, you know, I started starving myself at 7. And so I was put into counseling at 7 before everything like came to light, which I was like 12 when everything came to light and my parents found out and everything kind of imploded. But before I would say I was like put back together, like I started being able to put the pieces together when I was in my teens. And I had been a straight A student all throughout, you know, whatever. And then, you know, I started like not being able to pass classes. And which was for me very out of character. And I was 68, so I'm 5'4". I was 5'4" at the time, and 68 pounds. And so my hair was falling off. I was my body was growing this, like, I always call it like a soft fur called lanugo, which is like, you know, your body will grow to take care of it, like to heat itself. And but then on my 17th birthday, I was raped by an acquaintance. And so it just sort of like pushed me all the way back. And it took me a couple more years just to get it together. Not to get it together, I hate using that term, but more of like acknowledging that I was committed full time to healing, and I wanted to be I wanted to heal so I could be the adult that I wanted to be. And so I've been in recovery for anorexia, let's see, my early 20s. But it's definitely something that, even now, I mean, I'm pretty open about that, like, you know, if I've ever lost like more than a few pounds, I mean, granted, now I've had 2 children, right? So like my weight has fluctuated over the years, and, it's one of the things that my medical team monitors. And, you know, I had a longtime therapist that I would check in with. But just like all of those day-to-day things are, it's all so messy. And then I think that people lose sight that like, they don't understand that the event itself, whether it's a chronic or acute trauma of sexual violence, right? It's fucking terrible. But what is the most fucking terrible, the worst part of all of it, is the aftermath. Because no matter what you say you would do, no matter what you think is going to happen, it never turns out that way. You're never going to react like you're like, oh, I would never do X, Y, and Z. Or I would, you know, I hear a lot like, oh, that would never happen to me because I'm going to, you know, fight back, or, you know, or people dealing with like, oh, I didn't fight back, you know, because I was too scared. And it's like, no, you survived. That was the most important part of this. And that is a very natural reaction to being assaulted. And like, just, I wish more people knew that it is not the aftermath. I mean, it's not the event itself that is the hardest part. It is the aftermath. And yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of my.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I greatly appreciate you, you know, for sharing everything that you've shared today. And, you know, you obviously have an open invite anytime you want to come on the podcast.
Yeah.
You obviously have an open invite. And is there anything else that you wanted? What was that? I'm sorry.
Glad we were able to make it work, because like I remember when we first talked about it, I was like, I can't come on until I get this concussion stuff under control.
Yes, absolutely. I definitely remember that.
Yeah.
And you know, is there anything else that you wanted to share with our listeners today, or anything, you know, to kind of like give some inspiration to people that are maybe listening right now?
I think one of the things. Okay, well, this kind of is another like thought I always go back to, but like I always find, and it doesn't matter what it is, right? That people use victim blaming language and attitudes because of fear, right? They're like, it's why people want to, like, what was she wearing? Why was she out that late? Why was, you know, I would never do that. It's to make themselves like feel better so they can sleep at night, right? If I could say one thing to people, is that to be very, very aware of the language that you, when you talk about sexual violence in your community, whether it's in front of people or when you are hearing stories, be very, very aware of the language that you use, because you might not be a future survivor, but someone that you love could be, and they may not disclose depending on what you say. And so I see a lot of it, you know, on social media, and like as good, I mean, there's good and bad, right? But social media, like, I think a lot of people are more open to talking about some of these issues because they see other people doing it, right? But then when you share stuff and then you don't believe a survivor, you are hurting someone like that you probably love that will never disclose because of that. Like I was at the beauty salon early this week, and there was a new client there in the chair getting her hair done. And she was basically talking about someone that she knew that was a survivor. And she's like, well, that would never happen to me. I would just fight back. And it's like, there were four of us in this like area, and it was like, you know, don't place the blame on survivors. Like, rape happens, sexual violence happens because of rapists, predators. You know, you are the most effective instrument for change. And I love seeing people acknowledge that and recognizing that each person has their own power to make it better for survivors. You know, I think if more people recognize their power, things would move very differently. And so I think that that's like, if I could give like one piece of advice to anybody, whether it's, someone that wants to disclose and has been nervous to, or someone that's witnessed an injustice, you know, is that recognize that you have the power to change this. And there are people out there that, like, you know, that will talk to you and have answer your questions. Like, no one expects you to be an expert on any of this. You just have to like say, okay, I want to get involved, or I want to help, or I want to see this change. You know, so I think, I mean, that would be my advice, is like, you have the power, really in any work. Like, don't believe that you don't have the power. It's really my biggest advice to anybody.
And it's honestly the best advice to give, is we have the power to be the change. We have to be the change, because I've come to realize that if I'm not the change, change is not going to come. And yeah. We have to be the ones that recognize these issues that continue to uprise and run rampant throughout our communities. Yep. And, you know, I appreciate you and all the work that you do. And I absolutely...
I appreciate you taking the time today. I mean, I think... I mean, it's part of my core mission as a human in this world is to talk about this. Because I'm sure that you recognize this, right? It's like, you know that there's somebody out there that's going to listen that needs to hear what you're saying.
Yeah, absolutely. So I absolutely appreciate you and all the work that you do.
Anytime. And I appreciate it.
With that said, you take care of yourself, and I will talk to you very soon, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you, my friend.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye.